This podcast is made possible by the generosity of listeners and viewers like you. Kindly consider a contribution through Patreon or PayPal. Links are in the details box. Any amount is appreciated. And follow us on social media. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. The handle, The Beirut Banyan. Rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. And to stay updated with video releases, subscribe to our YouTube channel. Thanks for listening, and thanks for watching. I'm Rani Shattah, and this is The Beirut Banyan. I think most of the people in the audience know some things about Ralph Baydoun, about his career. I got to know you through social media, and I'd like you, if you could, just to give a brief background into what took you into this world to begin with. Mm-hmm. I know the thinnest layer. I know that you transitioned from traditional media to a more online media emphasis. And I know that your data analysis is focused primarily at times on online content. But really the motivation to get sucked into this world, and in particular, Lebanese media.
Ronnie, first of all, it's a pleasure to be here with you all. I think my career evolved around communications, the field of communications. And the first part of my career was centered around the creative part and the production part of the communications. So from media to humanitarian, that's creative and production. And then I moved to strategy with the British Council. I worked in strategy in the development field in Lebanon. And so technician, strategist, and then the research part. So it's a full circle in the field of communication. And I felt in 2020, the world witnessed the first ever disinformation campaign on a large scale, a state-sponsored disinformation campaign around the COVID. And it was traced back to the Kremlin. Mm. And I think that was the biggest factor of me transitioning into this world. I felt the EU realized in 2020 that the extent and impact and reach of the Russian network worldwide. And I felt that the Arabic social media and Arabic echo chamber is left unchecked. Mm. So basically, that was the biggest indicator for me to build influencers, my startup, and start working on in this field. And the first project we did was the elections. We monitored the elections. That was our entry to this world in Lebanon.
So let's go back to 2020, that you saw that Kremlin-backed disinformation campaign online. Your work in traditional media at the time, I hope I got the years right, it starts at OTV, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
Yeah. The one and only OTV, right?
Yeah.
Those years in traditional media, did you see something similar happening in the way traditional media was covering a disinformation campaign online? Because I'm curious where the transition, or at least the curiosity, comes from in leaving what could be a more comfortable existence into something that's far more independent and I think difficult to manage anyway. So where does that switch come from?
It was a natural transition and a natural development of my career, where I started in a very political media institution.
Yeah.
I got to see how political campaigns are prepared and cooked and disseminated. I got to see the politics inside the media institutions, and then I got sick of it and I moved to humanitarian. Mm. And then I got sick of humanitarian because I also saw the politics of it. I covered the Syria crisis for 4 or 5 years, and I traveled with I took the refugees route to Europe. So we traveled to Greece, Macedonia, Serbia, Turkey, Iraq, Syria for a little time. Mm. And I got sick of it. And then I moved to development because I felt change happens in the development sector in a country. where you work with institutions, where you work with the government to change the system from within. And then the uprising happened in 2019. When the uprising happened, we were working on a big program with the British Council on violent extremism and countering violent extremism. We had a national strategy with the government. We were implementing it. And we had this context update element that we needed to do to refresh our projects whenever something happens in the country. And the online aspect was also was always missing. And I was asked to do that, to fill this gap, and to research the online echo chamber.
Right.
And this is where I saw that there's only a handful of Lebanese people that do what I do. And there's only a handful of people doing it worldwide. So this was, it was a natural transition, and here I am.
I feel lucky that we got to have our own private podcast episode a few weeks ago. We sat over coffee and I took so many notes. And then I realized that you have a wealth of information that you've accumulated over time. Which I didn't know, though, is that you had that almost an allergy to political meddling in media. So it kind of makes sense that influencers has its own maybe terrain too, and that you're covering at times what is state-led misinformation online. So I appreciate that you're always looking at the political identity, if you will, of media in the background.
Yeah.
Before we get to influencers, we mentioned when we met earlier a thing that I had forgotten about, which was Cambridge Analytica. And that goes back to 2016, if memory serves me right.
Right.
Is that the first time there's that sort of real effort at altering an algorithm? So, or at least at that scale, was that the first time that it reached?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
But not altering algorithms, but actually how they manipulated public opinion before the US elections.
Yeah.
They looked at each state and saw the factors, the extreme factors in this state. The factors that, like, for instance, if you look at a Republican state, what they hate is refugee issues. They don't like abortion. They don't like different topics. So they played on those topics.
Yeah.
So for each state, they tailored content that feeds into that division and plays on this on those elements.
Mm.
Yeah. So they increased the division in the U.S. and they polarized the crowd.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is the first time ever recorded online manipulation through Facebook. And they changed a lot of regulations in Facebook after this incident.
I think it's last week or 2 weeks ago, it became more public that even Meta in general, Facebook, Instagram, and I guess WhatsApp, maybe not inherently, that it's now the default option is no political content that is naturally promoted, that you have to follow the content directly. Is that, that's also an extension of that awareness?
Like, the West in general is waking up to the idea that the internet is infested with disinformation and misinformation and also stupidity, if I might say.
Stupidity.
Yeah.
That's where I fit in.
No. I mean, like, regular people could go online and spread information with misinformation without knowing. By the numbers of likes, that gives them authority and people believe that. So they realize that they can't fight it. They can't fight it in a traditional way. They have to go hardcore on it, and this is what we're seeing in Canada, for instance. There's a news act that was approved recently. In Canada, you don't get to see political content on social media because they frame it that It's not fair for the media outlets. We need to monetize this content going through social media, and social media needs to pay media outlets. But the truth of it is they just don't want political content to spread on social media and be accessible for people. They're making it hard for people to actually get the right information. Any information, actually.
You know, I'm going to save that to the end because that was the more interesting update in how a country handles online, or at least public opinion on social media vis-a-vis news. That's an aggressive measure to actually remove that kind of news from social media. But we can save that to the end.
Why? Because they realize the importance of what we're seeing and the impact of it.
Yeah.
And I always go back to this, to the very beginning of cinema history. In 1896, when Frère Lumière did the Train Arrival film.
Right.
It was a 20-second film.
Yeah.
And if you go online and write Train Arrival, but right next to add to it, people's reaction.
They ran.
They ran out of the theater when they saw the train coming. So our brain is that primitive. It still perceives what is coming out of this black box as the truth. Of course, we have evolved from that moment, but unconsciously, whatever we read, whatever we see online affects us, affects our emotion, and indirectly feeds into our beliefs.
I'm going to try to take what you've said already. There's key words that we talk about all the time. Misinformation is obvious, but you already mentioned the ability to use hate, or at least divisive issues. Going back to 2016, at least the way we understood it, which is Cambridge Analytica became public knowledge later, but feeding off of emotions and then polarizing. As a data analyst or somebody that's monitoring online data, beyond likes, or let's say the stuff we see as audience, meaning views or shares or quote tweets, quote posts, whatever, how do you measure the impact exactly? Is it a numbers game? Is it actually, are those the metrics? Or is there another way you use, in a way it's silly, but measuring that influence?
Like, it depends on your goal. If your goal is to build a community like this one, you don't need the numbers. You need engagement. You don't need the numbers of likes, for instance. You need engagement. You need people to interacting with you. It depends on your goals. Anna, for me, for instance, I don't really focus on the number of likes in videos. I focus on the number of the average time watched and the number of engagement. Because what we're witnessing right now, we're witnessing a transformation in the digital age, a negative transformation where our social media is being infested by a lot of fake accounts. And with the age of AI, it's becoming really, really easy to create those large botnets.
Yeah.
So numbers are meaningless. So this is why quantitative analysis, when it comes to social listening, how many people liked the comments, or how many people reacted positively or negatively, this is not of interest to us. What interests us is what type of conversations, what type of narratives they are mentioning you, and what type of feedback you are receiving. This is what's important to us.
I'm sorry, these are like amateur questions, but how do you actually measure engagement in that sense? Is it, you said time watched. So yeah. you're able to actually look at the total number of seconds, for example?
Yeah.
That content's being looked at.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
May I ask how you do that? Is it something that...
The insights on your... Like, if you go to Instagram...
Right. No, I meant other people's content. Let's say content is being shared virally. How do you measure that engagement exactly?
It depends. If you're working with a client, you have access to their social media. But if I'm analyzing the impact of a certain incident, but maybe it would be beneficial to introduce what is social listening, because many people don't really know what that means. If we're monitoring a certain incident, We run our algorithm and we scrape, we get the data of social media from Twitter, from Meta, including and Telegram, and the overall web. So you scrape that data, you scrape, you run your algorithm in a way to get all the mentions of the topic you are researching.
Mentions, meaning you're looking for those keywords.
Keywords.
Yeah.
So if we're talking about, the grain deal, Russia-Ukraine grain deal.
Yeah.
You're looking for wheat, food security, grain deal, in multiple languages, and then you run your algorithm over your over social media. Mm. Of course, you have to first come up with a scientific sample to run your algorithm on and acquire this data. And then second step would be analyzing this data, analyzing what are the themes of the conversation. Within each theme, what are the narratives being disseminated? And then you could go an extra layer where you can understand the source of those tweets, whether they are authentic or inauthentic. And of course, you can run also a network analysis. You can see how the evolution of a trend, where did it come from, the actors that disseminated it, and their interactions among each other. You can do all that.
And that's client-based, is that... in other words, you need to get some access to that level of content, I guess.
No. I just described, I can do this...
You can do that on your own.
Yeah, on my own, yeah. For any topic. Mm. And for instance, the latest research we did was on the Tucker Carlson and Putin's interview.
The supermarket that shines in Moscow.
Yeah. So basically, you wanna understand what how this interview is being portrayed in the Arab region. You get from the research that Russia, it's consistent with Russia's strategy in the Arab region, portraying a strong Russia, a weak United Kingdom, with a weak monarchy. Weak leadership in the United States, technological supremacy of Russia, Soviet era reminiscence.
Yeah.
You've got Russia is supporting Gaza, Russia is supporting the Arabs, military cooperation with Egypt, atomic cooperation with Egypt. So this is what you get from analyzing the reactions on Putin, on Carlson Putin's interview.
This, again, very primitive question. How do you do that? For example, what would a keyword be in that issue?
Putin and Arabic.
So as straightforward as that.
Just keywords. Yeah. We're looking at keywords, and the code just gets all the mentions of those keywords. It's as simple as that. But maybe let's explain what social listening is.
Sure.
So social listening is the process of understanding what people are saying about a certain topic. That's one. What certain groups are telling their people and how they're reacting to it. It enables us to detect offline events that are being discussed in less visible spaces online. And of course, it serves as an early warning system to detect offline events before they even happen. And it helps us understand the evolution of a trend over time. That's broadly what social listening is, and that's broadly what we do. Why do you need social listening? Because every research, in order to build any strategy, you need research. Data-driven research. In the old days, we used to do it differently. We have two different types of data, primary and secondary. Secondary is the data that you can find online.
Yeah.
You can find within your stakeholders and partners. you don't pay for, basically. Primary data is when you design your own research research questions and the survey. You have quantitative and qualitative. You disseminate your survey over a big sample, and then you conduct qualitative research and analysis with a smaller sample where you interview them or do focus groups. But then we discovered that people lie. So the insights you're receiving from the focus groups and KII are not really accurate.
Yeah.
So you need to complement it with the age of data. You need to complement it with data that you can find online about the behavior of the people you are studying.
There's an evolutionary aspect to this, that you're monitoring over time how people react.
Yeah.
So is that just literally time? You have to look at one issue and see how it evolves online?
Yes. Or, yeah.
Because I'm thinking, how do you keep up with that? Let's say there's a fleeting issue, and we're going to get into the weaponization of this stuff. But is it that you're constantly monitoring?
It depends on the budget.
Right.
Honestly, because it takes a lot of resources in able to sustain this operation over time. Mm. But basically, yes, you can monitor how many times, for instance, Tripoli. I'll give you an example. One of the researches that we did was analyzing the WhatsApp the WhatsApp echo chamber in Lebanon.
Yeah.
And what I mean by monitoring a topic over time, you can simply monitor how many times Tripoli was mentioned in the news discourse and in which form it was mentioned, in which theme. What was it mentioned in a security type theme, in a tourism type theme? So in our research, we found that when we monitored news over 2 months, we found that certain WhatsApp news groups mentioned Tripoli only in a security type.
Meaning war or violence or...
Violence, crime, theft, social unrest, demonstrations. Mm. That's it. And that is not considered disinformation and misinformation. And this is my argument with all the programs that are being implemented to fight disinformation and misinformation. It goes beyond that, because to find misinformation and disinformation is like finding a needle in a haystack. We look broadly at the overall narrative in order to understand those nuances. Because in that, unconsciously, when you see Tripoli, when you read and hear about Tripoli only in a security type narratives, indirectly, you don't want to go there. So this is how you monitor the evolution. And then you see it in the second month or the second year. No, Tripoli is being mentioned in another form, like tourism or education.
You know, that gets us closer to state-sponsored potentially disinformation too. But just one more question about the linkage from online content to more mainstream attention. Did you see that early on? It doesn't have to be OTV, just in general.
What do you mean?
That something is trending online and it's being taken seriously enough that more traditional outfits are taking it seriously too. Did you see that evolve?
Oh, yeah. Like, it's a successful TV media outlet would have their own social listening tools and structures in order to pick on what's trending online and speak about it on mainstream. It goes both ways.
Right. But not to make it specific to OTV, but just in general, was that part of the manipulation, let's say, you saw in terms of politics penetrating discourse?
It could be used as a source of manipulation, because what social listening also allows you to do as a strategist and as a strategic communication, it allows you to capture the ideas of your target base. sometimes they are more creative than you.
Right.
So they can come up with theories and arguments that you haven't thought of in the political bureau or the stratcoms unit.
Yeah.
And they give you ideas. So yeah, it could be used. It could be the source also of news and of narratives.
So it becomes meaningless over time, what is mainstream and what is online. It becomes one ecosystem.
Exactly. We go back to the authority factor.
Yeah.
And here I want to maybe introduce, go back to the two-step flow, to the two.
Yeah.
It's called the two-flow stream of communications. This is the theory where the theory suggests that in order for our brains to believe an idea, we have to first see it from a mainstream media and then verify it by an opinion leader. This theory came after World War II. So back in the days, opinion leaders used to be our colleagues, our family members, our, you know, like the people in our neighborhood, our friends. But right now, with the age of digital media, the mainstream, of course, we have the TVs that remain the mainstream. But also when we see Al Jazeera with a blue tick online, on social media, you perceive it as authority. And the second layer of verification that we need right now in our age is going to the comment section and seeing the comments, checking for people we know commenting and checking for the highest number of likes towards on a certain comment to verify whether we believe in this content that is being shared or not.
Right.
This is how we accept it. If I see you, Ronnie, commenting on a mainstream post, I see, what are you saying? Are you commenting positively or negatively? And then I build my decision on that, influenced by you.
And so that actually extends to your current work, too.
Yeah.
So this is actually really rich terrain here. Weaponization of social media, looking at the audience. Did you see manipulation there?
100%, especially here, especially in this war, war on Gaza.
Okay, so let's as much as you can, the maybe what took you there to begin with, because that's new territory. So where did you see that yourself and therefore pursue it?
Yeah.
Because I don't think many people touch this stuff.
Yeah.
Scientifically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think we're one of the first people. Yeah.
Yeah. So what took you there to begin with? What was the topic that took you there?
So disinformation, botnets, and all that element is of interest to us. We've been observing it in different and multiple contexts, in Lebanon and outside Lebanon. But specifically, when the war started, I was engaged fully in the war, if you want, on a media level. And I started observing the people who work with me started observing this inauthentic pattern. Drawing on our previous experience with those botnets, we saw something fishy happening that we could not fully explain. And what was it? It was basically because let me explain how bots traditionally worked. If we want to work in the context of Lebanon, let's say if I want to create a bot army in the context of Lebanon, I would first write the Lebanese names. I would come up with a list of Lebanese names, 100 Lebanese names. Then I would write 100 description for each profile. And I would generate 100 picture for this army. And then I would multiply it by 10. So I would have 1,000 botnet. Of course, when they're dispersed, you're not going to detect that this person is the same person. You're going to have different account names. You receive the key messages from the Stratcoms team at the political party or the state. It gives you the key messages, and then you disseminate those key messages over the web to to create a trend, to drive a certain narrative, to engage and amplify the voice of the voices of certain elements within your party. But the transformation we're seeing now, and usually and traditionally they were dumb, so they only relied on the key messages fed by the Stratcom. The evolution we saw...
These are not individual users. These are automated responses, or is it...
No, it wasn't automated response. Yeah, sorry. It was automated in the sense that, yes, they reply. They have a query to reply to a certain person, sticking to the key messages received by a human, right. By the unit, the strategic comms unit.
The unit.
The unit,
okay,
yeah.
And that... could actually be a human being doing it. It's not, okay.
Of course. Yeah. When you don't have the technology and you have the numbers,
right,
you can easily do it.
Yeah.
Yani, political bureau meets, comes up with a decision, sends it to the Stratcoms. Stratcoms finds the, decides on the right channels to disseminate this, whether it is internal stakeholders or the general public. When they decide on the channels, because it could be your official speakers, and it could be indirect speakers, like via journalists that are perceived as affiliated to you.
Right.
So this maintains plausible deniability.
Right.
But you want to send this message, so you send it with someone who's affiliated but not a member of your party. Yeah.
So
you send
more credibility that way too, for the audience that's watching. Or.
It steers public opinion in one direction, but it could also mean that you're sending a message to a friend or an opponent. It could have different meanings.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then the third level is public opinion. So the third, and how do you disseminate it to the general public? Of course, the Stratcoms would send it to the comms unit, university units. They would send it through WhatsApp groups, and they would give them broad key messages, and they let the individuals in those groups create their own narratives to disseminate a certain message.
I see. So it's okay. That's to avoid copy pasting the same thing over and over.
So the same we're seeing now. We saw a communication army that is completely human. And we saw also the communication army that is fake. But the evolution right now with the fake, with the fake army is that for the first time, we saw that Israel used large language models to connect their bot armies to ChatGPT systems. Or not only ChatGPT, they could have built their own large language modules, feeding it information that comes from the Likud party. Netanyahu, all the tweets of Netanyahu, scrape all the tweets of Netanyahu, put them in this LLM, learn the rhetoric of Netanyahu and give me a response that mimics a Likud member. And when they're connected to the internet, they're connected to the tone of voice of certain elements, and they have updated information. So you don't, their responses, the botnet's response is not dumb. You know, they don't just stick to 40 beheaded babies, 40 beheaded babies. No, they evolve over time. They see that the trend of 40 beheaded babies is gone. They move to something else, and they tailor unique responses for each comment. They have the ability to tailor specific responses. So it's like customized propaganda.
How did you sense that? You said that you felt instinctually that something is wrong, something is off.
Yeah.
Is that through data or is that through your own sort of...
Both. Instinct, not from my side, from also the developers I worked with, I work with. And there was also in the developer words, they started talking about this in, those Reddit and the Discord groups.
Yeah.
They started, actually, there's a theory that's called the dead internet theory. Sorry. Can I get a cup of water, please?
Yeah, of course. Maybe Ryan? Can I, yeah, could we?
Thanks. So, 2 years ago, when ChatGPT was launched, a theory came out that is called the dead internet theory. And what does it say? It says that soon the internet will become 99% fake. The content that we see on the internet is going to become 99% generated by either artificial intelligence or by botnets. So we kind of detected this trend ever since ChatGPT was launched. And this is why Elon Musk, although I don't like to...
Thanks, Ryan.
Yeah, don't perceive this as an endorsement, but Elon Musk at some point asked for a 6-month halt on AI advancement. And this is why. Because of that, because...
99% meaning almost entirely either artificial or deliberately designed disinformation.
Yeah, in 2017, I think there was a report generated saying that around 56% of internet traffic is generated by bots.
When you're looking at Israel in particular, let's get first to your own instinctive reading. What did you sense was off that made you feel like the comment section is not authentic? It's artificial or it's state-led? Or both?
First metric you look at, we call it deep profile analysis. When you take a sample of people commenting and you see, and you measure what are the common patterns, how many times they're commenting and engaging, when the accounts were created, and how many followers do they have. And you can run also network analysis where you see if they follow each other, because this is how they amplify. But also, 5 years ago, there was an article and a mini documentary published by The Guardian about Team Jorge. And Team Jorge was exposed on camera saying that they manipulate public opinion online, and they have manipulated some 30 elections, presidential elections.
Team Jorge is a company?
Team Jorge is an Israeli startup.
Oh. Okay.
That does this type of services.
Yeah.
So it all added up. We know that they have a lot of innovations in that field. They're advanced in that field, and they lack the human numbers.
Right.
The pro-Palestinian people crowd is much larger than the pro-Israeli. So they lack the numbers. Of course, they need to use malicious botnets to steer public opinion in their direction. So it all added up.
But that's you saw that yourself. So you felt like these accounts had...
Plus, I asked my community, I needed more examples. And once I asked the community on Instagram to send me photos and links of people they're engaging with, that fits a certain criteria that I set.
Mm.
So I received so many examples and we analyzed them. And then we created our, in order to, to prove that this is being done, we came up with a theory and we created the same technology. So we reverse engineered it. The hypothesis was, they're doing it through LLM. They're feeding it a certain type of data set that is centered around few people, few mentalities. So we created the same thing.
For a stupid person like me, reverse engineering it, what does that actually mean? What is an LLM?
LLM is large language module. And reverse engineering is just thinking how they created this technology. They created this technology. We started putting hypotheses and then we worked following that methodology.
Yeah.
And we achieved the goal and we did it.
And it took you to... a feeling of that this is state-sponsored, that this is...
Of course, this is state-sponsored because it costs a lot of resources to engage in this type of activity. Right now with LLM, each response costs around less than a dollar, but a significant number. And if you're responding to 10,000 of people, that's costing you money. And no one can sustain this but a state.
So this artificial and artificially designed botnet, which I think is just meaning on scale, that it's at the tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, if not more. Is that today how public opinion is being shaped by states? Because that's interesting that you're looking at Cambridge Analytica roughly 10 years ago, which is Kremlin-backed manipulation. You're seeing...
No. I'd give the big caveat on that.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
This is how it's being perceived, that it was a Kremlin-sponsored, but no, it was really Cambridge Analytica and Trump team, Trump Stratcom's team. But of course, Russia is going to use this vulnerability.
Yeah. That's better said. You're right. Yeah. Let's say Kremlin manipulated... Public opinion, sure. With Steve Bannon on one end, with Trump, yeah. Which I think he was very open about it later. Today you have Knesset-backed propaganda. Mm. Can you just describe what exactly does that mean? Is it that they're literally pushing a button whenever there's an issue, yeah. And then public opinion, you have very, comments all over the place?
Yeah, I think Israel is one of the few states that has a strategic communication ministry. So let's break it down. The war cabinet meets, decides on something, and they want to disseminate whatever decision they made. They send it to the strategic comms ministry. The strategic comms ministry sends it to stakeholders worldwide, starting with embassies. Okay, they just write 10 key messages, 40 beheaded babies, tunnels under the Shiva hospital, rape, so on and so forth. Okay, they send the key messages. They send it to organizations, Friends of Israel, everywhere, worldwide. Mm. They send it to all the synagogues worldwide. They send it to their embassies. Let's take the Israeli embassy in Serbia. The ambassador receives these key messages. The embassy itself sends it, actually reformulates it in Serbian, adds a little context-based tone into yeah. it, and then disseminates it through its allies and journalists and media friends in Serbia. And this is replicated all over the world. So
yeah. You
have one consistent strategy, media strategy, being implemented worldwide at once. That's, we're talking only on a diplomatic and media level. So whoever BBC is going to interview, they're going to stick to the key messages received by the Israeli strategic comms ministry. They're going to stick to the key. And then you've got the social media game. For the social media game, yes.
And that's in the strategic...
Yeah, of course.
Ministry.
Yeah, of course. Okay. They have a budget. They allocate it to external partners, yeah. External stakeholders. And Israel is also one of the few states that outsource a lot of their services, mm. even within the army. So, they have the money. They receive the money from the Americans and their friends, AIPAC and whatever. They receive this money. They allocate it to... This and that.
How does it work on social media? Are they, I mean, what is it like? Is it, they just, I mean, I don't know the mechanism.
They work on different levels. Yes. They work on a strategic level with the social media companies themselves. On a strategic level, they lobby within the organizations to implement their own policies.
Is that like on a basic level, certain words get less friction, less attention?
Exactly.
I see.
Yeah. Or they come up with new regulations. They lobby for new regulations just As a side note, Jordana Cutler, who was the head of media for Netanyahu and was head of media in the Israeli embassy in Washington, she's right now the representative of Israel in Meta.
Oh.
So she is the link between the Israeli government and the Meta management, where they advocate and censor people. They advocate for new regulations and they censor people on demand, and they implement whatever Israel wishes on demand. So yeah, you've got on management part, you've got TikTok, for instance. If they don't succeed in their negotiations with TikTok, they go to the Congress and try to blackmail TikTok this way. In Canada, okay, they can't work on social media. They affect the Canadian lawmakers in order to remove political content from social media altogether. And for the Arab region, I think it's the only place that is left unchecked. I don't know about Southeast Asia. Also, like, I'm not aware, but I think here, where they don't have the lobbying advantage,
right?
We see their bot armies manipulating. Yeah.
So taking that example and maybe steering it slightly towards Lebanon, we spoke about this and we found, I don't know anything about this stuff. I know very little amount. We talked about the role of social media, not necessarily through state-sponsored propaganda, which is what you're talking about, but even among influencers, that they can shape the narrative. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't take them seriously. And we talked about this. We don't need to name names here, but let's say artists, the loosest term, or even a stand-up comedian has a political thought. That person may have an outlet too online, and then they share what they think is their reading of whatever, society, culture, politics, history, you name it, and they could get it fundamentally wrong. I still don't take it too seriously, but if I remember right, you were really convinced, and you convinced me too, that I should take it far more seriously. Yeah. So let's get into that. Maybe on the Lebanese level in particular, why social media is playing a critical role in shaping narrative.
Ronnie, as I explained previously, the two-flow stream of communication, when you see an idea on mainstream and it is automatically verified by those macro-social influencers, macro or micro-social influencers, stand-up comedians, influencers. But honestly, like, for stand-up comedians, I don't envy them. Because they're in a really tough spot, because Lebanon is one of the most complex socio-political contexts, or the most complex.
Maybe the most.
Socio-political context. Yeah. And it's a full-time job for some people to understand that,
yeah,
and to research that. And I'm afraid that some influencers who don't know the impact of their role, lacking the awareness needed to understand this context, sometimes play into the hand of actors that do not wish the best for Lebanon. This is the nuance. This is what I fear.
Can I ask, how do you see that playing out online? Is it also through engagement that content is more amplified than it should be? I mean, how would you read that, literally, when you're looking at it, that it's potency, let's say? How do you measure that? Because I, from my side, I dismiss it. I think, okay, they're not really...
No, again... So sure, you have the engagement metric. Mm. That tells you a lot. And you don't only measure the narrative of those influencers. You have to measure it in the backdrop of the overall narrative of the country, what is being disseminated on mainstream media, on the alternative media, and on like with those influencers.
Right, okay.
So when you compare their narratives to the mainstream media, you understand that maybe they did not mean what they said, or they did not think it through fully.
So it's really about individual verification. It's trust, I guess, is what you're saying.
Trust is the main factor. Like to take what they're saying at face value.
Yeah.
If I trust you, I'll take what you're saying. This is the power of propaganda. It makes you believe the unbelievable. And it makes you work against your own interest.
Let's go maybe as deep as we can into that. Is there a particular example you've seen where this played out? At least in Lebanon.
In this war.
So let's talk about how you read it. A trusted person online is sharing disinformation and then measuring the impact.
It doesn't come in. It doesn't have to be misinformation or disinformation. It could be harassing people saying we don't want war in Lebanon.
My sense, I don't know if you read it the same way, was that criticism of Hezbollah was being... Now, let me say it better. It felt like there was a weaponization of criticism against Hezbollah.
By whom?
That, I don't know if I'm saying this the right way grammatically. Criticism against Hezbollah was being treated like Zionism.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, totally, yeah.
And that felt more authentic than AI or...
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
There's no AI here.
There's no AI here.
No, no.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
And even in the, like what you said earlier about the comments section, it's people you know. It's not,
exactly.
It's not, at times it does feel like there's some fake engagement, but that's maybe the minority, not the majority.
The question here is actually whether it's an organic weaponization of criticism or whether it is a strategy, it's a policy by the political party.
So when you're reading that information, did you ever stumble upon the political party stuff?
Yeah, of course. When you see, you can't say for sure. But
not as sophisticated as the Israeli ministry, nothing like that.
It's the same methodology.
I see.
When you see that media people that are affiliated with certain political parties are disseminating this narrative, their friends and allies on social media, they're disseminating the same narratives, and their class A political people, class A meaning deputy ministers, journalists disseminating the same narratives, you build kind of a holistic picture that, okay, the full elements of this party is being engaged to support this narrative.
Mm.
If it was organic, you would have one element and then the other element correcting this narrative, saying no, taking the higher road, maybe rectifying what's being shared, like engaging with their people, saying no, we need to play the high road now.
It's like on a thin level, did you see more of the organic than the political?
Of course, the organic is always there because, again, propaganda makes you a catalyst for a cause. And it makes you believe the unbelievable. And it pushes you to become a kind of a disciple for this idea. So you always have this organic. But sometimes the organic alone does not create a trend. You have to have all the elements playing in the same direction to create a certain rhetoric nationwide. To create a fake enemy that would give you an exit plan in case of a military, I don't want to say defeat, I would say a stalemate. If Hezbollah, at the end of the day, at the end of the war, when the war ends, if Hezbollah will have to agree on the terms, and it's So they lost few opportunities to end the engagement on the borders, and the more we wait, we're losing, the more the deal is going to become more favorable to the Israelis. This is my take on it. And the more we're going to lose as Lebanese, if Hezbollah loses, we're going to lose as Lebanese, of course, because we're not going to liberate our land. The Israelis will probably get more concessions for peace, for relative peace. So Hezbollah needs an exit plan when this happens, when 1701 in one form of another or another is being implemented, or by creating a buffer zone. So I need to go to my community and say, this war did not happen for nothing. Yes, we right now, yes, we agreed on a buffer zone, but we gained internal political gains and we saved Lebanon from a civil war, or we saved Lebanon and we're taking the high road. And hopefully Hezbollah will seize the opportunity to play its role as the bigger party right now in Lebanon and the bigger brother right now in Lebanon that does not really beat up his younger brother every single time to achieve his goals.
I'll ask one more question about Lebanon, then we can go back to the Canadian example of maybe state intrusion into how we digest news. One more question. The built-in polarization that I think gets more engagement and more traction on social media. My understanding of nuance is that it doesn't belong on social media. If you're nuanced today, you're going to lose the game in terms of numbers, engagement, whatever. Yeah. And I think that's a silly game to begin with if you're trying to get facts out there. It seems more like it's designed for disinformation, which is what you said.
Exactly.
And what's the quote again? Propaganda can do the most unthinkable? Is that the quote?
It makes you believe the unthinkable.
Makes you believe the unthinkable. Let's take that in a maybe less dramatic sense and just apply it to what we've seen in this country. I don't know if this is true or not, but the polarization online makes you become either you're siding with Israel or you're against Israel in Lebanon. There's no shade. And I'll give you one example. Fact-based criticism of Hezbollah is seen as pro-Israel.
Sure. It's seen.
Fact-based.
It's seen. Yeah. It's perceived.
I've heard this said before, and you said it already, which is true, and I think Hassan Nasrallah admitted it himself. They started this on October 8th. This is not an opinion. It's fact. Even that is sometimes seen as favorable to Israel, but on social media, that's seen as extremely problematic, that you're speaking Israel's language.
Yeah.
I don't know if this is there a way to counter that? You're researching it. You're seeing it getting worse and worse. Nuance, and something you said earlier, correction, organic correction sends the right message. I don't know. I think organic correction sends you into the margins on social media. Maybe those that you want to see it. But in general trends, I don't know if that really catches.
Absolutely. In terms of numbers, you're not reaching, you're not winning this war.
Yeah, exactly.
The populist, the most populist you are, the most traction you gain. And the design, the design of the algorithm propagates and amplify those voices.
Right.
So it's not a fair game. And also, we're not doing much to solve this problem on a lobbying level.
Yeah.
With Meta on a governmental level, like, have we taken this issue seriously in Lebanon to lobby for it in international forums, like with Meta as a country?
But no. Does Lebanon have a representative to Meta?
Every country has supposed to have.
Is it you?
No,
it's not you.
So it's not. You're not gonna. Nobody's gonna like my thoughts on this. When you have a polarized country, already polarized country, non-existent media literacy and social media—it's a recipe for disaster. It's a recipe for disaster, and it's spreading very, very bad information, and it's amplifying very, very bad actors, and I don't see a good way out of it. I don't see a good way out of it.
I've seen the darkest language from the 1980s trending on social media. And like, it's what? Like community hate.
Oh, yeah.
And that seems like really Civil War language, but it's getting traction. I've seen you sometimes call it out too. So you're reading it, and I sometimes see hints of it from people you wouldn't expect to. I always think that they're getting sucked into the algorithm. They're looking for traction. But then again, I do like to differentiate the what I think of as flimsier people rather than serious yeah. analysts. But I think you're right. It doesn't matter online. As long as it has some check or maybe it's enough numbers and followers, it's taken seriously.
Yeah.
So that danger, and then suddenly Canada is taking measures into their own hands. I did not know about this until you told me. So you can't access news on social media in Canada. What does that actually mean? That you can't see news bulletin or headlines or links? What does it look like?
The algorithm does not suggest political content or news from CNN, Al Jazeera.
So I open Facebook or whatever.
You don't see that. You just see your friends, your group's interests.
Wow.
You don't see news.
It's like 20 years ago.
I mean, whatever works for each country to preserve their security and prevent chaos. Because that's the main thing. What social media is doing right now, and this is actually the bigger Russian strategy. So doubt and confusion and distrust in the system. When you create that, you're actually disintegrating societies without actually, like you're subverting societies without actually engaging militarily. This is what's happening globally.
That's at a huge level. That's state-sponsored. That's Putin-initiated doubt. I sense that that's also happening among people. Yes.
Happening here. We analyze context in Lebanon, in Egypt, and we see the same findings.
Yeah.
We see the same narratives.
But that's not Putin intrusion into Lebanese affairs.
No.
That's Lebanese doing it on their own.
Mahir, Kamen, you can't all link it to one source because you get influenced by a certain narrative and rhetoric and you start replicating it. You get influenced by a conspiracy theory spreading online in the EU and then spread it here without knowing.
Last question before we take a break.
Yeah.
You mentioned earlier that you're able to reverse engineer. Can you do that at scale? I mean, I know you're, in a way, it's not, maybe that requires state-backed funding, but would you be able to reverse engineer everything back to its source? After all the AI stuff, after all the fake users, after all the...
We could replicate everything, yes.
Yeah.
With the right resources, we could replicate.
Does anyone do that, trying to get back to where this is channeled from?
Yeah, I mean, like all open source companies and research firms try to do that most of the time.
Yeah.
To trace... So, for instance, Bellingcat, they did it they tracked... The assassins of what's his name, Navalny,
right?
Putin in his first assassination attempt.
Yeah.
So open source intelligence helped uncover the unit that was following Navalny around. So of course, this is the job of researchers to trying to unpack and understand how this technology is being applied, to understand certain questions, and of course, you can replicate it. When you have the right resources.
There's so much more I could ask you, but we don't have that much time. I'm going to ask everyone, if you haven't ordered something, take advantage of what's left of Happy Hour or Wine and Cheese at Alia's. Let's take a 10-minute break. Yeah. And Ralph, this is fascinating stuff. So thanks to you and thanks to the audience for joining. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. So guys, let's make this Q&A fun. I think a lot of us are friends with Ralph as well, so you can ask him personal questions. You can embarrass him. How's Fizz doing? We're in audios instead. There's going to be a mic being passed around by Ryan. So does anyone have a question up front? The gentleman in the middle.
Hi, thank you very much. So I'm Canadian, and I heard you speaking about the Canadian social media news landscape. And I don't really have a question around this, but I did kind of jump on the idea of misinformation, which is maybe a little bit ironic because it seems that you were actually spreading some misinformation around the legislation, Bill C-18, the Online News Act. Which actually was not intended at all to ban news from social media platforms. This was an unintended consequence that was unforeseen. The purpose of the legislation was actually to get social media platforms to pay news outlets for the traffic that is generated to them that then does not make it to the news outlet. So it was actually a way for policymakers to try to direct resources from the social media companies to news outlets. And of course, Facebook's response, Meta's response, was to not do that. And they would rather just not show the news than pay those fees. But this is actually modeled off of something that Australia did in 2021. And I think the perception was that just like in Australia, Facebook, Google would come to the table, they'd make a deal. Eventually, Google did make a deal, but Facebook has not. And there have been times when the government has actually begged Facebook to come back to bringing news, such as when there were wildfires last summer, and they were met with a cold shoulder because big tech simply did not want to pay. So any response to that?
Thank you. Of course, when we first talked about this, I told you the reason why they're doing it. And I'm going to re-explain it the way you did. Of course, it's the pretext is monetization of content, of the media outlets. Of course, that's the main legislation. And the unintended consequence of this move is actually the banning of social media. I am neutral to this legislation. I don't care if... and this is why I said whatever works for Canada. So it has... Of course, it has a monetization aspect. But of course, also, it has another factor, like the other factor which comes within this information battle, within this information war, it happened right now. And if I look at it from a security apparatus, each country does in the information system what's best for the country. So in Russia, they have their own game in terms of censoring information. And in each country, they have their own games. Whether it's under the pretext of monetization or not, the unintended consequence remains the same. So I did not mean to talk about this in a negative way. I totally understand the Canadian government. From a security apparatus, it's a nation of migrant communities, and they understand the danger of political content being used right now and manipulated the way it is right now.
Actually, let me interject here. Since we're lucky, we have, and I'm going to put you on the spot, sir, I hope you don't mind. We have a former member of parliament from Canada sitting with us, Marwan Tabara, is that the name right? Could you give your opinion since you retired from Canadian politics? And are you the reason we're having this argument?
I just had this conversation with him, by the way.
Yes, and I was explaining to the speaker about that, and I was the one that voted for this legislation. I was...
Okay, so you guys beat each other up outside, and let's continue.
No, I voted. He's speaking correctly. I'm agreeing with what he's saying.
Canadians.
What he's saying, I won't overlap what he's saying. It's I absolutely believe in that. Correct. Where this is coming from, to kind of simplify it, is when we watch Super Bowl commercials, for example. The Super Bowl's, you know, the United States is 350 million. Canada's only 40 million people. So when we're watching that, the Broadcasting Act asks whenever there's a commercial break that it has to be Canadian content. So what this bill was trying to preserve is trying to preserve Canadian content for artists. I'm adding another part of it. He's added the one piece. Canadian artists, an overwhelming majority were asking, you know, we need legislation to protect some of our work, some of our music. To give you an example, when the radio station's playing, instead of playing just American music, we have a certain percentage that we want to keep to try to encourage more artists. So that's part of the legislation. That's one part of it. And that was the second part. So it's and it came from the culture minister to preserve Canadian culture.
The question in that in this conversation maybe portrayed what you didn't want to hear, what you perceived it like, that there's some sort of censorship being implemented in Canada, but this is not my intention. This was not my intention. The question was, okay, what are different countries implement, like what, how different countries are dealing with their social media problems and challenges? And Canada did it this way for a certain objective, for a certain target audience. The unintended consequence of this, yeah, what we said. So different countries address this problem differently. It depends on the problem.
Thank you, sir.
I hope I answered your question.
The gentleman in the front, could you introduce yourself? Are you a member of parliament from any country?
No, member of parliament. Hi, Jonathan, you know my name. I'm from Germany. I'm not aware of any German regulations at the moment. I have another question to you. You talked about this dead point of the internet and that at one point 99% of all information would be AI or bot generated. And I already heard about talking that maybe at one point there's a tilting point when internet would lose its credibility and maybe this huge advantage of being able to spread information super fast and being globally connected would then be outplayed by this trust issue. And maybe at one point there, I think people talking about that you go back to only when you talk to someone in reality or you have a phone call or you have a rally by a politician, but in real, then you trust this and then this whole internet bubble would maybe like implode at one point. So I just wanted to know if you have any information or any idea on this.
Yeah, totally. This is why Israel goes above and beyond to cancel Al Jazeera, for instance, because they realized that this trend of the dead internet theory, the spread of misinformation, the malicious activities online, will actually push people to go back to the trusted sources, to mainstream sources. And this is why governments try to harass and censor those entities. So yeah, there's a new theory also, the building on the dead internet theory. People suggest that at some point we're going to have two types of internet, the paid internet and the unpaid internet. The unpaid internet is where all that malicious activities happen, and the paid internet is where just the real authentic people, you could do a level of verification that's related to your passport, your electronic ID. So yeah, we are heading in this direction, or we are heading to the just letting go of the internet and social media. But I think this is hard with the technological advancement that we're living.
More questions? The gentleman in the front. Oops.
I'm Charlie, also from Canada. Wow. I just wanted to know why you...
What the hell? Really?
Shufiqi.
I just wanted to know why you joined OTV in the beginning. Maybe
good luck tonight.
Nick, I applied to multiple TVs and only OTV accepted me back then. And it was literally the first year of college. So I needed a job. I needed a job as a technician. And I was politically active back then with the Free Patriotic Movement. And yeah, a lot of development happened, like personal development happened ever since.
And also personally, what got you into the whole field?
Sorry?
Personally, what got you into the field?
Say that again.
Personally, what got you into the field?
Personally?
What drove you into the field personally?
What drove me into which field?
This media. Whole communications.
Research or communications?
Just everything you're talking about.
I don't know if you were here when we started the podcast, but I said in 2020, two elements, uprising in Lebanon and understanding that nobody is doing what I'm doing in Lebanon, which is understanding the narratives and the sources of the discourse online. And two, state-sponsored campaigns, information campaigns, that in 2020, the disinformation that happened around COVID and tracing it back to the Kremlin and understanding the network's reach and impact in the world and in the Arab world. And we're talking about a field that is relatively new. And I saw that we have an advantage because what separates me, our company, from the competition is understanding context-based discourses and understanding Arabic. In Arabic, we have more than 12 dialects. Social listening tools in English is relatively advanced, but in Arabic, the AI and this, all the technology we have right now does not understand the subtleties of our language and the sarcasm within our dialects. So I felt we have an advantage. I have an advantage. So this was the main factor, basically. Cool. Thanks, Charlie.
Other questions? Someone in the back, is that right? Yes. Ladies sitting.
Marhaba. From Lebanon.
Thank you, Samer Al-Khoury. A round of applause to Samer for national identification.
You spoke of social listening, and I kept wondering whether or not the media, having been like this bridge in the gap between executive powers, policy making, how is this new religion of science affecting policy making in terms of normative principles being quantified and the notions of democracy via public opinion, if everything is now lacking in normative principles that constitute
simple English, please. What is this question? Jesus.
How is our new conception of the media and its influence in creating new narratives affecting our notions of democracy? At least what the people can give and what the people affect in terms of the overall policy. How are the people being affected by a genocide that's digitized? And that's what's their role to play in there is a social listening is muffled.
So that's more the psychological impact of.
I mean, when you say social listening, I wonder who's listening to the social. Is it people like you, or is it government bodies, or is it?
It's government. It's governments. It's academia. It's researchers. It's civil society. It's a collective of entities, and. Of course, you measure, like when I talked about social listening in the context of early warning systems, you measure how many times the term genocide is being used, where and which echo chambers this keyword is being used. And if you have historical data, you would have an inflection point where, you know, for instance, if this narrative reached a certain point in terms of a reach and engagement on social media, this is going to lead to an offline event. When we see a certain trend evolving in the Syrian context, for instance, or in the Iraqi context, or in the Egyptian context, we know that this is going to lead into an offline event, whether we're talking about violent extremism or we're talking about public distrust in the system. So you can use social listening to understand the whole, you know, a lot of topics, and it can shape policy in each, and it can be used to shape policy, and it should be used to shape policy, and it is being used to shape policy, not by the best. By the best people. Let's say like intelligence units all over the world use this. civil society started to use this. For instance, if we want to monitor how many people are discussing the bread price in a region, or the fuel price in a region, or if you want to understand certain needs within a certain community or a certain geographic area. Yeah, so social listening could be applied and all that.
Thanks for that question. The lady in the front.
Julia from Canada. No, from Italy. Not going to accuse you. I just have a curiosity. So you spoke about the manipulation of data that happens in manipulation in general in Israel for especially today. So I was curious to know if you studied or if you saw some manipulation of data, for example, during Thawra in 2019 in Lebanon, something that happened similar.
Well, how do you define manipulation? If you want to the sort of activities that we saw online was not from artificial botnets, but it was from specific groups and specific people to actually smear the other parties or to amplify a certain narrative. It was organized, but not malicious. There's a difference. I explained earlier that how political parties disseminate a certain narrative or a certain idea through a certain structure. This structure could be human or could be artificial intelligence. But in the case of Lebanon, we have a lot of people that are unemployed that have Twitter accounts, and they could serve, they could disseminate the parties' narratives and discourses online. So this is the sort of manipulation, but it's also the game. It's also the game online. Everybody wants to convince you of something, whether it was systematic, structured, prepared, researched with focus groups. Like, this is the best approach to tackle this idea. This is the best response to this accusation. This is what happens.
Other questions? I know that, the member of parliament.
You don't have to keep mentioning that. Thanks. But this is more of a comment, and I'll relate it a little bit maybe to Lebanon. But I read a really interesting article where Finland, in elementary school, they teach young children how to form opinions on misinformation and disinformation. And there's a certain curriculum that the government has brought forth. Legislation was introduced in 2014, and it's to tackle misinformation and disinformation. They argued coming from the Kremlin, from Russia. Do you think that governments can have a positive role in maybe, you know, helping establishing that? Because we're so bombarded with so many news articles, social media. Just wondering if that can be maybe implemented here in Lebanon if things are a little bit more stable.
Absolutely. I believe change happens top down, especially in countries like Lebanon. And there's a need for media literacy in Lebanon. And media literacy comes only if it was taught in schools and in universities, to be able to be critical to the information and assess the information you're receiving, to question it, to judge it, and basically make your mind about it. So yeah, definitely. And this is what we lack. In Lebanon, we don't teach media literacy as a part of the curriculum. It is basically introduced as crash courses in some universities, which does not have any effect. So yeah. But also, one more thing. So I'm not entirely sure if media literacy, in this case, in the example you mentioned, they introduced a program to fight misinformation and disinformation. But this is where this is my argument with every policymaker or expert on this matter working on Russian misinformation. It's not misinformation and it's not disinformation. It's the whole story they portray about a certain country or about themselves. And this story is not misinformation. It's basically based on truth, but it's tailored in a way that portrays a certain image. So if you want to talk about the Russia-Ukraine war, it's how you communicate about this war. How many times you mention Russian attacks against Ukraine? How many times you mention Ukrainian attacks against Russia? How many times you mention
Nazi, the word Nazi comes
the Nazi theme. How many times you mention that the West is abandoning Ukraine, which plays into the narrative that the US and the West are not reliable allies. When you mention, and this is not measured in misinformation and disinformation. This is why I said it's like finding a needle in a haystack. You have to look at the whole broad narrative to understand, to quantify those answers, those questions I just mentioned. Like, if you, how many times this narrative that sowing distrust in the West and American support, and this leads eventually to policy change, pivoting with Russia because, the West is weak. This is the image we perceive. The West is weak. The West will abandon Ukraine or will abandon you as a state. But Russia will never do that. How many times the conservative values of Russia are being portrayed? The Eastern Orthodox against LGBT. The weight of this conversation and the impact of this conversation. This is not LGBT. This is not misinformation. But this... the weight and the scale of this conversation steers public opinion towards Russia. And this is what we're missing, I think. Yeah, sorry.
Hi, Joseph.
Hello.
I have two questions. The first one, in the previous issue of Harvard Business Review, they mentioned that number of likes is not as important as number of comments to drive sales, to drive engagement. I would like to hear your thoughts on this. And the second question is, we know the number of youth around the world, particularly in Lebanon, is increasing. And
the number of youth?
Youth, yes, okay. Is increasing. And they are rewriting journalism. They are influencing information on social media and so on. Based on your experience, how the youth can play a positive role in fighting misinformation and maybe encouraging positive trends on social media?
Thank you. It has to do with the national policy. If the state wants to educate and wants to achieve this objective, they would implement laws that will strengthen and increase media literacy among the youth. Otherwise, we are setting ourselves up for failure. Unfortunately, this is the trend.
May I ask, in addition to that, and this my memory of Social Dilemma. Have you seen that movie?
Yeah.
I don't know if people have seen this movie online on Netflix. It's mostly about Instagram. I know this conversation is way beyond Instagram, but my memory of the psychological benefit or the perceived benefit of numbers and number traction. What would social media look like without numbers? I mean, would this stuff work? Ooh. So let's say there's no likes, there's no views. You simply are just seeing content without knowing if it's gaining or losing.
A big part of social media is validation.
Validation. And the validation comes from those hearts or from those numbers. Hearts meaning likes, I guess, on Insta. I think they are hearts on Instagram. Yeah. So that, the views is new. Elon Musk added those to Twitter, which to make it compete with other platforms that have those numbers yeah. more visibly. I do feel better when something gets 100,000 views as opposed to 1,000. But what would it look like? Would these bad actors have that leverage without the psychological good feeling, that primitive thing where I think in the movie they're showing somebody almost gambling away all the time. Like it's a, you're winning all the time when the numbers grow.
I don't know. I don't know. You would remove validation and you would remove authority from content.
Yeah.
The audience would look at the content without the sense of authority. Like, so they would question, they would be more critical.
Yeah.
But malicious actors would still use social media. Like,
sure.
On Twitter, if you use the same methodology you use on Instagram by clicking on the comment of a certain content to validate it, you would see a whole spam of malicious, inauthentic activities, like different videos about different topics that are not related to the original content.
But I'm going to guess the comments feed off of the numbers of views and likes. Comments on low traction content mean less, I suppose, in terms of influence. Like something that gets 1,000 views and 1,000 comments is not as dangerous as 10,000 views and 1,000 comments.
No, it's the opposite, actually.
Oh, it's the opposite.
Yeah, it's creating a whole conversation, an echo chamber within this conversation.
Even though it's limited in terms of its traction.
Yeah, but you've got 10,000 or 1,000 people commenting. Mm. Those people are, if we're talking in the case of an actual conversation, actual people, they are spreading this message in their offline world and in their online world.
What if we banned comments too? What would social media look like if it wasn't so social, I guess? It's just media. You can use your brain again to know that the train is not coming. It's an image.
Yeah. Interesting.
Thank you.
I mean,
I'm the influencer.
You would remove the engagement part. You would remove, so it's not profitable for social media.
You mentioned the whole money thing in Canada, monetization. I mean, most of us remember life without social media. Before Facebook, I guess.
Yeah.
None of this stuff mattered. Mm. That's 2 decades ago.
Life was simpler.
Life was simpler and politics was more understandable. Mm. This trust thing is so critical to the story. I do think, and maybe I can ask you this before going back to the audience, that the things that get most engagement are the things that sow most doubt. Those are the more extreme versions of whatever is happening. Mm. I think that's been my experience on social media.
Yeah.
At least in Lebanon.
Fear sells.
Yes.
Fear sells.
Yeah.
Fear makes you click on the...
Right.
This was one of the findings in our WhatsApp research. When we researched the WhatsApp ecosystem in Lebanon, we saw that the news that have an element of fear or warmongering were clicked on the most. That's an element of human psychology. You want to understand the risks surrounding you.
I always struggle to understand why is a company worth $1 trillion? And I think this is it. It's just constantly feeding off of human emotion. There's no, otherwise, these companies don't make sense. Out of nowhere, $1 trillion. And then the world's richest man can buy one and take it and play with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, I took up some of the Q&A. We can have maybe one or two more questions at most. Yes, the gentleman in the back. That would justify me having no followers, no likes, no comments. I'd live happily ever after.
You do.
Hi, how you doing? Just a quick one from me, and not to like muddy the waters further, but I guess don't we also need to be slightly wary of the sort of disinformation industry that's now sort of appearing? for instance, who gets to dictate what disinformation is or misinformation is as well. There's a lot of actors, often malign actors, often state actors, who like to determine what misinformation is. And indeed, they're setting up organisations and bodies to do so. But through their own organisations and bodies, they're actually propagating this stuff. I'll just give one quick example, which is there's an organisation called the Global Disinformation Index that some people might be familiar with. And they used to like send me and other journalists, et cetera, press releases about what they are doing and raising issues of concern. Now, I looked into this organisation and they were actually funded by the Charles Koch Institute. Charles Koch, obviously one of the Koch brothers, right at the forefront of climate change disinformation, right at the forefront of it in terms of spending millions of dollars denying climate change as well. And at the same time, funding an organization which is called the Global Disinformation Index. So don't we just need to be slightly wary about who dictates what disinformation is as well in this sort of realm of information?
Yeah. Was that a question? I didn't get it then.
I guess like don't we need to be conscious of the fact?
Oh yeah, totally.
Yeah, there's a lot of actors here, state actors, etc., who like to define what misinformation is, and in actual fact, they are the ones right at the forefront of pushing it.
Oh, yeah, definitely, and this is why I don't focus a lot on misinformation per se, like as a term, or disinformation. I focus a lot on the broader image and the whole spectrum of narratives that are being circulated. We do content analysis. So we analyze the different themes of the conversation. We don't judge whether this is misinformation or disinformation. We only do that when we dig deep and deep into it to verify. So it's the last element in this whole thing. Thanks.
You know what? I'm going to give the mic to a former guest on the podcast sitting at the corner, a psychologist, actually, Amira Cazon. You can ask the final question. I know you had one during the break, so you get the final one.
Thanks, Ronnie. I always try to think, to reflect on a societal level. So how do you think what's happening on the social media impacts the social contract? How do you see that maybe now, maybe in the near future, maybe on the longer run, how do you see that it will impact what's happening in Lebanon?
So the EU realized that what's happening on social media is leading to distrust in the system, confusion and doubt. So usually the goal of information warfare is not to make you believe in the opponent's idea. It's just to make you distrust your own ideas and your own concepts. And I believe this is what's happening here in Lebanon. It's increasing polarization. It's making stupid people popular. And it's a recipe for disaster in Lebanon. We have to tackle it from a holistic perspective on a national level. We have to tackle it in a participatory approach with all the elements of the society. It needs to be, we need to have a holistic approach to solve this issue in Lebanon. Otherwise, it's a recipe for disaster.
I'm reading...
I don't want to end it on a very bad note. So no, try to come up with something positive.
Rarely have I been turned to for an optimistic ending. You know, I'll try to hear between the lines that I know that this is not a blanket statement. It's more that our respective experiences through media, in particular social media, are having a net negative impact on society. It seems like this is the conclusion, that the positive trends that could be there are not matching the negative trends.
Yeah.
And to sort of add to what you said earlier, stupid people are becoming popular. Perhaps malicious people as well are becoming trustworthy.
And that's where I always find this fragility between free expression and mania and societal degeneration. And I don't think they should not be the same thing. There should be a way to engage healthy discussions without adding fuel to fire and causing societal decay in the long term. And I think that's really our generation is watching this thing spin out of control. And then maybe belated efforts, whether it's Canada or even, I don't think Canada is the only country that's been trying to sort of put guardrails. And I think their focus is primarily always online. It's not in the human experience. It's mostly online. But I live in the narrative world. That's what I do for a living. And I think your emphasis that it's not about misinformation or disinformation, it's about the whole picture. And whether it's Putin or anyone else trying to reconfigure a story to harm, that's happening in real time.
It's not always to harm. It's also used to advance strategic interest in a direction.
That's a better way of saying it. You're right. Advancing strategic interests from actors that perhaps use that tool for survivability reasons, less to do for an honest debate. But those actors are thriving thanks to this. And I think in your very individual way, you found a way to make social media educational and fun. I like it when you're in an angry mood online. I like it when you go on Instagram and just start. It seems like you're venting, but you're venting about the media wars at play. And you're offering, I think, in my opinion, the best media monitoring in the country. And I think that's hands down.
Thank you.
So it's Influencers. That's the name of the company or the organization.
Yeah.
Perspective Leb on Instagram. We're plugging social media at the end.
Right. Yeah.
His real name is Ralph Beydoun. A round of applause to Ralph Beydoun.
Thank you, Ralph.
Thanks for listening and watching. And a friendly reminder to support this podcast by contributing through Patreon or PayPal. All links are in the details box. Until next time, I'm Rani Shattar, and this is the Beirut Banyan.